The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening, we're going to start a three-week series. I'll be teaching for the next 3 weeks on the body, the speech, and the mind, if you will, the sort of avenues of action that we can take in the world, and which the Buddha prescribed various practices that would help us to move toward liberation. We might think of body, speech, and mind as, I don't know, pathways is kind of a nice word that comes to mind that we can use to understand our mind. That's ultimately, you know, the main interest of the Buddha, but it has these various modes through which we can interact and learn and develop our practice. Here's a little quote from Hafiz. "What is the key to untie the knot of the mind suffering? Benevolent thought, sound, and movement." So that, in slightly different words, captures body, speech, and mind. So now, as soon as I've separated these out, I'll have to tell you that they're not really separate. Not that separate. I mean, of course, any speech that we make comes from an intention in the mind. Sometimes the words form in our mind, right, and then we say them. And of course, there are intentions in bodily movement. The way the body acts affects the mind. So I'm not pretending that these are totally separate realms, but it is useful to distinguish in this way. And so there's going to be a little bit of area where you say, well, she could have talked about that next week, but, you know, indulge me a little bit. So it is possible also to kind of focus on one realm at a given time. Like you could be doing practices with the body and focusing on the body while doing them, or you could be focusing on your mind, what's happening in my mind as I do this with my body. So you can see that there's kind of different facets of how to approach experience that cover these three different realms. But we'll try to stick with the body tonight. Certainly what we do with our body is consequential. I think everyone would agree with that. For example, how we hold it, how we use it, how we pay attention to it, and how we take care of it. Right? These are all realms that we can interact with our body. The body is certainly the key vehicle in ethical conduct, as well as speech. But we'll do speech next week. So not killing, not stealing, or committing sexual misconduct are largely areas that relate to the body. So the realm of our kind of outer behavior, where the body does a lot of the participation, is vast and an interesting place to explore. And we'll talk a little bit about that. In addition, there's the whole inner world of bodily experience, which we can really begin to touch into through meditation, right? Or mindfulness practice, however, yoga, other things that you got introduced to. So experiences that are very elemental, like heat, heaviness, lightness, tingling, clenching, spaciousness, softness, hardness, all these things that we encounter inside of our body when we start looking at it, really, we come at some point to realize this is what constitutes the body. You know, what's an arm? What's a leg? These are sensations, experiences that we can have. As we come to have more awareness of the body, at least it was true for me, it was almost like mindfulness could be called bodyfulness. And I know Gil uses that expression sometimes. I think it's wonderful. Direct experience of the body is so important in our interactions and other aspects of our practice. And it's also quite amazing once you start tuning into it, the incredibly varied experience that is the body. And we'll talk a little bit about that too. So one way to think about bodily related practices, if you will, is to see them in two different modes that I'm going to talk about. I'll elaborate each one. The first is to use the body to do practices, which then affect the mind. Remember, we're ultimately aiming at the freedom of the mind. But using the body to do practices. This is kind of straightforward. So, for example, Munindra, a teacher, used to say, just put your body there. And what he meant was sit on the cushion every day. He was talking with someone who said they were having trouble establishing a practice. He said, just put your body there. Just put your body there. And he meant what we do with our body affects the mind. We start to establish the habit of sitting. If we put ourselves on the cushion every day, even if it's for 10 seconds, because that's all you had time for before you really had to go to bed. Just doing that, taking the meditation posture every day, has a profound effect on our practice. The sitting posture itself. All of us are in some kind of sitting posture right now. And it's actually designed to be a stable and relaxed posture, right? How many times have you been told, take a posture that's both comfortable and upright, or that's both relaxed and alert, something like that. So there's a reason for this. It's not just arbitrary. It's that when the body is stable and grounded, it helps the mind to do the same. Not that it always works, just getting your body still does not mean your mind is still, for sure, but it's a support, right? It's more likely that that would be possible than if you were rushing around madly trying to clean the house before your partner got home, something like that. Yeah? So this general area of using the body for practices includes both restraint from doing certain things and positive actions, taking positive actions with the body. It's easy to have one mode that you're better at and forget about the other one, but they're both useful. So, example, stopping yourself from having that third piece of cake, right? So now this is not an ethical issue. There's nothing ethically wrong with having as much cake as you want, but you may, as a practice, take on, can I not fulfill that desire because I know I'm going to feel lousy later. Not because it's ethically wrong, don't beat yourself up, but it's just for your own benefit, your own comfort, your own health. So restraint of various kinds, and of course you can think of other, maybe more serious realms where that would be important. And then also positive actions, even ones that you may not want to do. So for example, offering that person at work the use of your stapler, that person you don't like, the use of your stapler when you see that they're looking for one. And you pick it up off your desk and you say, here, would you like to use this? Even though inside you're saying, oh, I hate interacting with this person and they were so annoying to me yesterday and they, did that thing last month and whatever. But still, you know that it's going to be better for you to offer that stapler in the sort of total picture of the universe, yeah? So taking positive action with the body. Now you'll notice that you need your mind to do these things, right? So to not have that extra piece of cake requires some mental action there. And also maybe picking up that stapler requires some, okay, I'm going to do this kind of action with the mind. So this is maybe our first explicit glimpse at the mind-body link, which I would guess most of you are already aware of. These are not really that separate. They condition each other. But we can see it clearly in actions like this, where we are moving the mind and the body together in deliberate ways that require some energy. And then there are also positive actions that are really, feel wonderful, like volunteering, like doing the walk to feed the hungry. There's one, the Buddhist Global Relief is sponsoring a walk on October 11th this year. And it's lovely. You just go and there's like hundreds of other people sometimes. And you walk together and you're raising money for, to help combat hunger. So these are positive actions that we do with the body. And it's different if you go and do that than if you don't, for example. Probably beneficial. So training the body definitely has an effect on the mind. Another example, maybe close to home for many of us, is sitting with pain. So it's not totally comfortable to to sit in this posture for a long time, sometimes even for a short time. And at some point, I think for almost every meditator, there's going to be pain. And sometimes even if you've worked through the initial pain, it comes back later. You know, there are phases in practice where the body is just not comfortable sitting. And so then, you know, there's the question of what to do with that. The body is sitting still, but there's this bodily feeling, right? Even the Buddha sat with pain, by the way. So one option in the realm of this sphere of bodily action is that we can do what's called breathing through the pain. So, you know, whatever area feels like it's tight or burning or stabbing, we can actually direct the breath using the mind, direct kind of breath energy or the feeling of energy in the body through that tightness, that pain, that stuckness. And, you know, it doesn't mean it breaks up and goes away and the light shines necessarily, but that's positive action that can be taken to address a bodily situation. It helps us ease the mind's tendency to fixate on the pain, which makes it worse. By the way, you may have discovered that for yourself. So that's a whole realm of using the body to do certain practices, and it'll come back as a... I'll talk about it more later when I do some other topics, but I want to make sure I mention the second mode. I said there were two modes of doing body-related practices. The second mode is actually to observe the body with the purpose of learning about it and also with the purpose of learning about the mind. Okay, so many body awareness practices are recommended in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha. He recommends, for example, becoming aware of the breath, of the posture that you're in. So right now you could be aware that you're in the sitting posture. Later you may get up and then you'll be aware that you're in the standing or the walking posture. And actually just keeping track during the day of what posture you're in is a whole practice that he recommends. How often we are just not aware of even what position we're sitting in. Also activities, so to know when you're eating, when you're reaching forward, when you're putting your hands above your head. Actually, he recommends very specific things like noticing when you're urinating, when you're defecating, when you're speaking, when you're remaining silent, so forth. So whatever activity you're doing, are you aware of that? He also recommends seeing the body as elements. It's kind of fun, earth, air, fire, and water. And these exist, you know, as experiences in the body. Not necessarily that we're saying these are the physical truths of what's going on, but they are experiences, experiences of hardness or of heat or of movement or of cohesion. So some of these things that I've described, these awareness practices, are external and some are internal, right? Activities versus how the body feels inside. Oh, he also recommends seeing the body as parts. So he recommends 32 parts to notice in the body. I know there's more than 32, but that's enough for meditation, is to try to go through 32 of them. So why are there all these body awareness practices? You know, what is this observation of the body that we're doing? So one function is to develop mindfulness, okay? We know that when we try to develop mindfulness, we quickly realize how often we aren't and how often the mind has slipped off. And it's sometimes even more difficult to be mindful when not sitting on the cushion, because there's all kinds of need to interact and think and actually do things. So The Buddha recommends paying attention to postures and activities and other external things in order that we can develop a continuity of mindfulness throughout our whole day, so that there's really no activity we're doing where we can't be mindful. So within this realm, it's actually very interesting to notice where you are habitually not mindful. For example, are you mindful when you're sitting on the toilet? Some people are. But sometimes you have the experience, people will notice they have the experience of they go in the bathroom and then the next thing they know they're walking out of the bathroom. It's like that's just gone from the realm of awareness. So that becomes interesting. It's not a failure. It's not something to search back into your childhood of why this happened. But you just say, wow, that's really strange. I had no idea that I paid no attention to that entire realm of my life. And so then it helps you to develop the continuity. Another function of observing is actually to learn about the body, okay, and also the mind. But we actually carry a lot of false ideas and assumptions about what the body is that have never been checked. And only very careful, unbiased observation is going to expose this falseness. Okay, you have a lot of assumptions about what your body is like and how it can move and what it can do. We're basically pulling the wool over our own eyes. And a huge realm of practice is to stop doing that in general. Now, we're pulling the wool over our eyes in all the realms, in how we speak and in how we think and cognize also. But the body is one of those realms where we're not totally aware of what we're doing. So Joseph Goldstein says, as kind of a summary of this practice, see what you do. This is the observation mode. See what you do. So he doesn't say, you know, walk into the kitchen and be very mindful about the choice of what to eat for lunch you make. Like, be really mindful of choosing just the right thing. Actually, what he says is, see what you do. So you go in the kitchen and you say, I'm going to make lunch, and you see what you pull out of the fridge. And then you look at that, and you look back on what that action was, and you say, wow, you know, was I choosing based on taste? Was I choosing based on health? Was I choosing based on who knows what needs to be used up before tomorrow when it goes bad? Something. There's something going on there. And if you go in with the idea of, I'm going to be the perfect Buddhist and choose, and then you've imposed your idea of what you think good mindful eating is, you actually miss what's really going on there. You know, you miss what your actual intention was. You miss what your actual value system was that was choosing that. It's not wrong, whatever you're doing, probably. Or if it is, you'll notice that and make some correction. But if you don't even know, so you have to actually let yourself go a little bit and observe what you're doing. Observe it without controlling it. This is a little bit subtle, and you'll have to learn how to do this in practice. You'll discover how much control you're actually putting by your spiritual ideals. James Barras describes a time when he was on retreat and he was doing super slow walking meditation. You know, like some people, I don't know if you guys have been on retreat, but sometimes people get really in, they really slow down and they're doing, you know, like each step might take them 10 or 20 seconds. And he had the thought while he was doing that, looking good. And then he realized, oh, you know, he'd fallen prey to an ideal in his mind of the person who's walking really slow is the best practitioner, right? This is a little bit the realm of mind, but he had his body kind of, the way his body was linking in with this ideal in his mind. So try just acting and observe what's going on. It may take some time to find some balance with this practice. So here's a story. I was taking a walk in the woods down in Santa Cruz several years ago, and I came across a book on the trail. Like, it was odd because it was out in the middle of the redwood forest, but there was a paperback book, looked very old, like from some used bookstore, and it was a book on vegan cooking. I was actually feeling quite free and open, and I thought, oh, that's intriguing. And, you know, I looked at it, oh, vegan cooking. And I picked it up, and I started walking with it. And that's not exactly the etiquette for when you find things on the trail. The usual thing, you know, you find a mitten or you find something, and the usual etiquette is that you stick it on the side of the trail in some prominent location with the idea that if the person looking for it comes back, they'll see it, but it's not been left casually where it might get stepped on. You know, that kind of cultural thing that we have about when you lose, something is lost on the trail. But I didn't do that. I actually picked it up and started walking with it. I didn't want the book myself particularly. I did at the time have a vegan housemate, and I, you know, the thought passed through my mind, gee, she might like this. Of course, it wasn't my book. So I didn't know what I was doing, actually. I thought, why? I didn't feel like I was doing something overtly wrong, and so I kept walking with the book. I thought, I'm just going to see what I do. This is really interesting. And I walked on, and after another pretty far, you know, quarter mile or something, I came up across a man. It was pretty wide trail. Bikes could actually be on it, and it was a man with his bike on the side of the road, and he was obvious side of the trail, and he was obviously fixing something on it, like he had the bike upside down and was, you know, something wasn't working in the gears or something. But he looked like he knew what he was doing. He didn't really need help with that. But next to him on the ground was a stack of crummy old paperback books. And it was clear from, this was not like a super fancy mountaineering trail bike kind of thing. It was like a beach cruiser or something. And it was clear that he had been riding the bike, he must have been carrying the books under his arm because there was no basket or anything on the bike and he didn't have a pack or anything with him. So he must have just dropped it, right? And so when I saw him and I walked by and I understood it, the scene, I said, "Is this yours?" And he said, "Oh, yes, it is. Thank you." So it was good I didn't leave it on the trail. Of course, I would have seen him later and I could have pointed him back to it. But what was I doing, right? I picked it up. I walked with it. So I didn't get caught in ideas of how I should be behaving, even in the realm of ethics. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to put the book in my pack and take it home. It wasn't mine. But it's interesting, right? So open yourself up and see what you do. I'll give another example of how both of these, I'll give an example now of how both of these can be combined. So using the body to do practices and observing the body to learn about either the body or the mind. Yeah, so Andrea Fella tells this story and I really like it, so I'll share it. She said that she noticed one day, she was in the drugstore, and she noticed that she was taking things off the shelf and throwing them into her basket. And after a couple items landed with a crash in her basket, she thought, whoa, what is going on? So she observed, you know, what she was doing. She didn't walk in saying, "I'm going to be a good Buddhist, you know, shopper and blah, blah, blah." She wasn't controlling her behavior in that way from her ideals. She was noticing, oh, look at this. And so she realized that because of her bodily activity, she realized that she was feeling impatient. She actually hadn't quite been in tune with that emotion. She wasn't mindful of that, but she was mindful of how her body was behaving. So right there is mode number two, observe the body to learn what's going on. So she learned, oh, I'm impatient. So then she stepped in and she realized, okay, it's very painful and uncomfortable to be impatient. It's actually not a good feeling. That's why people rush around and try to make things happen when they're impatient. It's actually very uncomfortable to hold that energy. So she then changed her mode. She changed to mode number one, use the body to do practices, and she deliberately slowed down how she was putting stuff in the basket. Like she said, I don't want to feel that impatient energy. She imposed then her practice and said, it will be better, it will be more beneficial if I am a little bit calmer. And so she deliberately slowed her body down. And from that, she said within 30 seconds, the impatience evaporated. Why? Because she was in a more calm action with her body, which fed back and influenced her mind. It doesn't always work this cleanly, but I think this was a really skillful kind of interaction with her world. That's why I love repeating it, is that she used her body to notice how she was, then she used her mind to change her body, which then changed her mind again. She got, you know, helped her ease out of that impatience. So now, let's try it. I want everybody to stand up. Wherever you are, stand up. Okay, now wait. Look back. So observe. Some of us are still standing up. Very good. And observe to yourself, how did you feel when I said that? You might have thought, oh, thank goodness, I'm happy for a stretch. Or you might have said, oh, I was so calm and relaxed. Why did she make me stand up? You know, and so did your body reflect? Like how you stood up, did it reflect? Did you leap up? What fun! What are we going to do? Or did you go, oh, geez, okay. You know, so, you know, notice if there was some kind of an effect there. Also now, how do you feel listening to a Dharma talk standing? Have you ever done that before? What about if I pace around in front of the room like a university professor? Should I point at the board? You know, this is not the usual way that Dharma teachers teach. Like if I walk out into the middle of the room, which you guys have all left conveniently open, right? This is intriguing. It's kind of fun for me too. I've actually never done this during a Dharma talk. So maybe I should try this more often. So we can use the body to observe. You know, does it feel a little funny in your mind? Ooh, wow, a little daring. All right, so another thing we can do is make a fist of some kind, doesn't matter which hand, and then like really get into it and like shake that fist and see if there's some effect in your mind. I mean, if you actually do that with some vigor, you feel any effect, or are you just totally detached from the fist? Maybe not. I'm just curious. So using the body to influence the mind, you can let it go and relax. You guys aren't very vigorous at shaking your fist. You're kind of... But maybe that's because your ideal says, Dharma people don't, you know. Okay, so you can relax. So stand in a way that feels easeful. So now something that feels kind of calming, whatever works for you. And just kind of, you can even settle into that, like the, you know, the posture of standing meditation, which is totally fine to do. It's one of the postures for meditation. And then from here, we're going to sit back down. So I'll ask you to sit down, but do so in a way that is, try to do so in a way that's natural. How would you sit down if you were just going to sit down and be aware while you're doing it, not imposing any Buddhist ideals, not imposing any idea of I'm going to have fun while I do this? Just sit. Was it hard to get your mind out of the way while you were super mind? Now, you may have just turned your mind off and you don't remember exactly how you got into the sitting posture. Or you may have, like I did for a while in my practice, your mind could not get out of the way. Once I told you, sit down naturally but be mindful about it, my mind would be like, how am I supposed to sit down? You know, I should probably do it gracefully. I should probably do it, you know, I should probably look a certain way if I'm being mindful about doing something. So this is interesting to see, right? So if this is how, you know, just the simple act of sitting down, it's very hard to get your mind out of the way. What else is your mind controlling from moment to moment through our day? Okay, so that was just a fun little diversion, but useful, yeah? So I want to switch now to talking about how we might change our relationship and our understanding of the body through practice. So I'm talking now about combining the quiet sitting posture, whatever that looks like for you, with the internal observation of the body, but letting it be in the observation mode, letting it express itself as it is while you're in this calm posture. So this is the process of Vipassana meditation. Things can get very powerful, actually, and so I'll offer a number of examples and the fruit that they can bring. We talked briefly before about working with pain by breathing through it, so that would be the mode of taking deliberate action with the body. However, if we combine doing that with observing what happens while we're doing that, like if we actually deliberately breathe through some pain that's happening, like in our shoulder, say, and then we kind of pull back a little bit from that deliberateness and observe what's happening as the air is going through, or the energy, whatever you want to call it, we'll notice that the pain no longer feels quite so solid. And this is one of the key insights to have about pain in the body, is that it's actually not a solid wall of pain. That's not how pain exists. It's actually shifting, changing, a series of sensations, like there will be maybe stabbing, burning, pulsing, tingling, often very rapid. If the mindfulness is strong and quick, you'll see that they actually turn on and off quite quickly, and often in a very small area. It might be a cubic millimeter or, you know, a cubic centimeter at the most, in a very small region, yeah, so all this is going on. And once you see this, the mind actually stops believing in the pain in quite the same way. It's very powerful to have the bodily experience of pain being something not solid and something changing. It may not go away. It may not ever be pleasant. You know, if it's some kind of a physical pain due to an actual illness, an injury, you know, it might really stay around for a long time. But the relationship to it can change because it's been observed to be different. It doesn't actually help you to have heard me say this, I'm sorry to say. It helps you in that you might be looking for it, but you have to have the direct experience of it in your own meditation for it to have the transformative effect on the mind's relationship to sensation. So this kind of open observation of the body is great in general. It's actually a great way to practice. I practiced for a number of years doing nothing but feeling my body sensations. I don't even know if I would call it breath meditation. It was so much focused on the body itself. And maybe I could feel the breath energy flowing, but it wasn't like Anapanasati. I was really exploring what is my body, what is this experience of having a body. So in that mode, we can experience energy, tightness, openness, areas of heaviness or lightness, a sense of having no boundaries. The boundaries on the body can get kind of fuzzy and disappear. We can even experience different shapes or sizes of the body, like you may be sitting with your eyes closed and it feels like your body is huge. Or you focus down and you feel like your awareness is like in a tiny, tiny region of your intestines, you know? Who knows? It's very different. So these experiences are often dramatic at first to realize, oh my gosh, I feel like my body is, you know, an elephant, some strange thing. But over time, they become sort of more commonplace. So the drama does fade eventually, and they're not necessarily significant in and of themselves, these odd bodily experiences. But what is important is that the mind's perception of the body is becoming more flexible and more variable. You don't have to see your body as an internal experience that somehow resembles what you see when you look in the mirror. I know that's mostly how we see the body, or how we have for the first part of our life, is we saw it in the mirror. This is what my body looks like. I look down, I see it. Okay, but when you close your eyes, it's something else, isn't it? Why is that experience less valid than what you see with your eyes in the mirror? You know, this is what my body looks like when I'm looking at it with my eyes, using light reflected off of a silvered piece of glass. And this is what my body is when I'm sitting quietly and have turned my attention inward. It's a different body, actually. The experience is just as valid. So when I did this for several years, I had a sudden experience of not exactly knowing what my body was. I suddenly thought, what is this? If all experiences of it are just experiences of the body, all equally valid, what is this? Maybe we don't know. This is even true on the physical level. I'll just mention this briefly because I like talking about it. I did a 6-day dissection course with a human cadaver one time, and it was quite an experience. I won't go into any detail, but I will say that my ideas about what the inside of the body would look like when it was cut open were completely wrong. They were total fantasies based on something I had concocted, maybe drawings or pictures I'd seen, something. That they were totally total fantasy. The real thing was quite different. Very worthwhile experience for the very reason of retraining my perception, of showing that my ideas were wrong. And then I started thinking, where else in my life are my ideas completely wrong? So the body is a whole world, for sure. And it can go, I described briefly, it can go in several directions. It can go toward this alien sort of idea of what is this? Not in a scary way, but just sort of in an open way. Wow, what is this? I don't think I quite know. It can also go in the direction of having less compulsion around attractiveness and sense pleasure. You know, we start to see that these things are fleeting in relationship to the body. Very hard to keep the body comfortable 24/7, although we try. And there's also things about the body that are kind of gross, right? That are unattractive, that are repulsive in various ways. These might be the realms where you don't have mindfulness if you start checking your activities during the day. There are things about the body that really aren't that attractive. So we can start to see that. I haven't gotten into the whole realm of body image. That's more in the mind. And I know that's a huge realm of suffering. And so I want to offer compassion. And that's actually the third way that investigating the body can go. It can go toward love, compassion, and befriending. I mean, you've got this body from now until the day you die. And it's not easy to live with a body. It's not that easy. We have to feed it. We have to clean it. We have to rest it. We have to exercise it. It's like we have to do a lot of things for this, to maintain this physical structure. And it takes a lot of effort. And it's just as hard for everyone else as it is for you, actually. And, you know, for some people, okay, you know, maybe much harder if they're medical issues, but that may be you someday. You don't know, wherever you are, right? So a lot of compassion for me has developed through observing my own bodily experience, hearing from other people about their bodily experience. It's pretty funky what this thing we're doing in the body. Living here, I mean, going through this life. Really, there's one poem, I don't remember the whole thing, but it says something like, every body a lion of courage. I think so. I think to take a body is a very courageous act. So all of these results, whether it's alien, oh my gosh, whether it's less compulsion about attractiveness and desire, and whether it's love and compassion, all these are good effects because they're different from the usual one, which is kind of taking the body for granted, seeing it how it looks in the mirror, driving it around like a vehicle for getting what we want in the world. There's a lot of other relationships possible, and meditation starts to open that up. The realm of bodily experience starts to open those up. That's very important for the mind. So seeing things in a different way, basically the conclusion from that, is the realm of insight. That's insight, is to have a sudden direct learning of something that's different than what you knew before. So the body is a rich domain for insight. One of the biggest areas comes from the obvious and unavoidable facts about the body, which are aging, illness, and death. And everyone in this room has experienced one or two of those, at least. And so these are definitely worth investigating in all the ways that we've talked about. So feeling directly the aging process of the body. Your body's different than it was 10 years ago, or 20, or 50 for some people in this room. And, you know, feeling, and so I want to be concrete. What is arthritis, really? What is it? It's a feeling, okay. You can get the diagnosis, you can look up online pictures of, you know, cartilage being worn away or whatever, but what does it feel like for you? Burning, pressure due to the swelling, sharp pain when you accidentally move wrong and the bone hits the bone. This is worth investigating. That's what arthritis really is. It's not a concept that was given to you by a doctor. Aging includes a feeling of fatigue and lower energy than we used to have. What does that feel like? Oh, I just, you know, I'm tired at 2:00 in the afternoon now. I can't get through the whole day. What's that like? The changing qualities of skin, hair, muscle, visual and auditory faculties. What's that like? Very empowering to observe these as practices and as realms of insight rather than realms of, oh no, or, you know, it's all downhill. It might be in some ways for the body, but it's, if you're observing it with insight, it's uphill for the heart or in the beneficial direction. And these are not easy, of course, so the associated feelings, you know, can bring out compassion and connection with others, common humanity of what we're going through. Powerful practice, actually. So is the realm of the body enough? This is an interesting, might be an interesting question. You know, I've talked about, the practices I've talked about could take the whole rest of your life. You can't get to the end of all of those. All those observations, very hard to complete those, I would say. But I was once talking with Pao Ok Sayadaw, who's a Burmese teacher, and I asked him if looking at the body is enough. And he immediately said, no, you need to look at the mind also. So he was clear that this is, for him, this was not a, you know, what he didn't think just looking at the body was a complete realm of practice. But there's another way of seeing it where looking carefully enough at the body leads naturally to seeing the mind. I don't think it's really possible to do, especially those challenging practices that I talked about earlier about, say, looking at aging. I don't think it's possible to observe that and not start to feel the feeling tone of that in the mind, not start to feel the ideas that come with that, maybe the anxiety or the relief or whatever it is that comes with that. Those are feelings then in the mind. And if you turn and observe, how is the mind responding to the body? How is the mind relating to the body? Then you're using the body to do a mind practice. And so it becomes, again, complete. For example, in the sutta about breath meditation, the Buddha explains how using the breath as an object, which is basically the realm of the body, breathing, leads through all four of the foundations of mindfulness. So all four of the realms of mindfulness, which include the body but also include the mind in terms of feeling and volition and other things that are going on. So just using the breath, we can go all the way. Actually, the sutta is very clear about that, that the breath meditation alone, and I think that's because it leads naturally from the body into the realm of the mind. Also, the Buddha told a practitioner named Rohitasa, who was a kind of a supernatural being, he told him that all four noble truths can be found within this fathom-long body, which is a nice phrase. So meaning that if all four noble truths are found in the body, that means if you understand that, you would have full freedom. So the body is an incredibly important realm of practice that will serve along the whole path. You don't need to feel like, oh, this is the first week of this series, we're on the body. Someday we'll get to the really important stuff. Now, I'm past the body. I'm ready for the next thing. No, actually, it's good. The body's going to be with us the whole way. And it keeps, in my experience, it keeps opening. It keeps deepening. It keeps offering more gems for understanding. It's really an amazing realm of practice. So good. Those are my current thoughts on the body, but we have a little bit of time, and I would love to hear if you have any questions or comments or thoughts about your own body practice. And Maureen would have a microphone for you for that.
Great topic. I couldn't help but getting conflicted when I was listening to what you're talking about. It seems to me like the mind is more important than the body. Maybe I shouldn't have drifted into that thought, and I should not think of one more important than the other. But I can't help but think in our world, we tend to focus much more heavily on the body. We do annual exam. We do all kind of tests. But I've never heard of annual mental health.
Annual mental health screening.
Right? And I think, honestly, mental health is just as important, if not more. Mm. So I'm conflicted because I hear you re-emphasizing what I feel like is maybe the wrong way of looking at things.
Mm. This is an important point. There's a sutta where the Buddha is in a discussion with some Brahmins, and they're talking about whether the body or the mind is more important, actually. It's the same question. And one of them asserts that it should be... I might get the details wrong. I actually wanted to include this in the mind talk, so I'll try to get the details by then. I believe one of them says that the Buddha would say that the body is the most important based on, you know, what he understands the Buddha's teachings to be, and he presents this idea, and the Buddha says, oh, no, it's the mind. So the Buddha is clear in this sutta. He agrees with what you said, that the mind is important. And that's because moving the body, of course, comes from the mind, right? The body can't move by itself. It's directed, or somehow, by mental function. A corpse doesn't move, right? So, and certainly what the goal of practice is freedom of the heart or freedom of the mind. The Indians didn't distinguish so much between those. And that's the only realm where freedom can come, okay? For sure, we know which way the body's going. The body's going from here towards decline and aging and illness and death. Wherever you are in your life, that's where it's going. And so the body is not a realm that we have control over in the end, and it's not a realm where we can attain any kind of perfection. It's just not the nature of the body. So for sure the mind is the realm to develop. So maybe I should be clearer now as we're concluding that the aim of all these body practices is to affect the mind. You know, it's insight that I've talked about and the understanding and the change in perception. All those words are mind words, right? So for sure what we're doing when we use the body in practice is to shape the development of the heart, to advance ourselves along the path. But it would be foolish, I think, to not include the physical realm. Our practice is one of embodiment, and it can be sometimes a little heady. I'm not sure I agree with you that we focus on the body. I think we're stuck in our heads, especially in Silicon Valley, where we're all very smart and that's what we value. Many of us sit at computers all day, so not everyone. I don't want to make any kind of assumptions about people in this room. But I think sometimes people come to practice with the idea there are certain spiritual realms that say you're going to transcend your body because the body is this dirty thing, just like all, you know, we said, it's going toward death. We're going to transcend that. We're going to have out-of-body experiences. We're going to enter the bliss realms of concentration, develop the mind into its full potent power of deep samadhi. You know, you've heard the rhetoric, right? I don't think the Buddha would agree with that. Remember, he went and did concentration practice as his first practice. He learned the seventh and eighth jhanas from his first two teachers. And he realized that was not freedom. And he turned around and he did ascetic practices, beating up his body. That wasn't quite right either. But eventually he found the middle path. And the middle path is one that includes the body and the mind and understands the function of each. And one function of the body is to serve as a realm of practice for the development of the mind, which is where freedom can be found, but not through an out-of-body experience. So I don't know if that addresses your question completely, but I appreciate it very much because I think it was helpful to kind of wrap them together a little bit more before we get to the mind topic in a couple weeks.